In case you were wondering, today's show is going to zero in a bit on England. We're going to be talking about English food on the show today. And if you're thinking plain and boring, well, you are wrong. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on WPR. Our first guest today is Carol Wilson. She's a food writer and historian and a member of the Guild of Food Writers, author of a number of books, including Scottish Heritage Food and Cooking, The Licorice Cookbook, and The Bacon Cookbook. And her latest is titled Regional Cooking of England, A Culinary Tour. Dandy book. What would you like to know about English food and recipes? Have you had some experiences that you'd love to share, maybe when you were in England and dining there, or maybe trying to prepare some English food here? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Carol Wilson, welcome, and thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, I really had a lot of fun with your book. You like to write about food, obviously.
I do.
Does that mean you like to cook, too?
I like to cook, and I like to eat.
What do you think food says about a country?
I think it says a lot about the history and the culture of that particular country. I think England has a very old tradition. I mean, we've got a lot of history. I think the first English cookbook was written around about 1390, which is a long time ago. It was called A Form of Curry, and curry was the old English word for cooking. And it had a lot of recipes in, some of which we'd recognise today, such as macaroni cheese, believe it or not.
From what year was that book?
1390.
Oh, so what did it look like? I bet it didn't look like your book. Your book is fantastic.
Well, no, it wouldn't have been a book. It would have just been written on sheets of parchment and in old English.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess one of the things I really enjoy about this book, and if those listening are, if you're thinking about traveling to England, or if you've been to England, boy, this is a wonderful book. And even if you haven't, it might inspire you to make the trip. I really enjoyed your history. Let's go to the 17th century. You write, that was a time of great change in English cooking. Maybe what are some of the biggest changes?
Yes, well, in the 17th century, things like tea and coffee were introduced to England. So that would be in the reign of Charles II. And chocolate, which was a very big thing, but probably not like the chocolate that we know today. It was a drinking chocolate and it was quite bitter. But chocolate houses and coffee houses were very popular in 17th century England. And Samuel Pepys, the famous diarist, mentioned several times that he was very fond of drinking chocolate. But of course, it was only for the wealthy. It wasn't for the ordinary people. They never got to taste tea, coffee or chocolate.
Yeah. How did tea become the drink of choice?
It was introduced into England by Queen Catherine, the wife of Charles II, and it was imported from China and India. And it became very fashionable because everybody, the wealthy people, wanted to copy the royal family. And so it began the tradition of drinking tea in the afternoon.
Mm. So what were the biggest influences on the English diet?
I think the introduction over the centuries of new foods from different countries, from India, from China, and from the New World. You know, we got potatoes, which are an English staple now, and tomatoes, pineapples, sugar became more widely available. The Crusaders first came across sugar when they were fighting in the Holy Land, and they didn't know what it was. They thought it was a reed that was filled with honey, and they brought them back with them. And sugar was extremely expensive, and it was regarded at that time as a spice, and it was kept in a locked cupboard with other spices. And so for a long time, it was only wealthy people that got to enjoy these types of food. But gradually, as time passed, with improved transport, these foods filtered down to the ordinary people, who tended to keep them for special occasions. Most people had a very plain diet, and things like dried fruit, sugar and spices were kept for special occasions. So that's why we have a heavily fruited cake at Christmas time and a simnel cake at Easter. And there were recipes in the book for those. They contain a lot of dried fruit, spices and sugar. And so we keep up the traditions from way back when, from before the Middle Ages. We still eat those foods.
Yeah, I was thinking as I was going through your cookbook, I came on the recipe for Cornish pasties.
And
It reminded me that England has, you may have gotten some items from the U.S., but you also passed along some great traditions from England to the United States, and especially to Wisconsin, because the lead miners in Mineral Point, I think that lead mining in which was in southwestern Wisconsin, lead mining became very popular, and it drew people from Cornwall in England because they were professional miners. And I'm pretty sure that those Cornish pasties, which are kind of a local thing, especially in southwestern Wisconsin, were probably brought, and I'm not a historian here, but I just guessed.
You're probably right. Yes, they would have brought their Cornish pasties with them.
I like them.
yeah, they're very tasty, yes.
Oh, man. Well, it's interesting to read about the history of products, and you mentioned some products. You didn't mention Worcestershire.
Worcestershire
sauce.
Yeah.
It's a funny word to say, but Worcestershire sauce, how they may have changed by, and even been changed by different cultures. Talk about that condiment for a minute.
Yeah, well, because England had a lot of colonial influence, the people who worked in the colonies, they brought some of the foods back. And for Worcester sauce, as we call it, we just call it Worcester sauce. We can still buy it here. It's very, very popular. We eat it with cold pies and all sorts of things. It was brought back, and it was mixed together. It's a secret recipe of spices and fruits and everything. And the people who made it thought, well, this doesn't taste very nice. So they just put it to one side and they left it. And because they left it for a long time, the actual ingredients matured and aged and they fermented, and it was a far better tasting sauce, and that's the sauce that we buy today.
Isn't that interesting? Oh my goodness.
Yes.
Has food in England become what's the right word, more homogenized in the last few decades, or is regional cooking still common?
Well, regional cooking is still common, and I think there's a renewed interest in cooking regional dishes, because nowadays we can buy food from all over the world. But those regional recipes are part of English history and culture, and we should preserve them. And they are still made, and they're only, some of them are only made in certain regions. For instance, Yorkshire curd tart, you can only buy in the county of Yorkshire. The rest of England, you wouldn't see that. Fidget pie in Shropshire, and scouse on Merseyside, which is a beef or lamb stew. But certain things like Eccles cakes and Chelsea buns and Cornish pasties have become available nationwide. So we have a wide choice of foods. Some of the old foods, some of the old traditional dishes have died out. Nobody makes them anymore. The recipes are lost. And I think it would be a shame if that happened to all the regional recipes that are in this book.
Yeah, which is one good reason why we have this book. I was thinking about my own time in England, a couple of trips. I went on our Wisconsin Public Radio sponsored a garden tour of England, and I looked at your map. You have the country sort of split up into six regions, and I have. This was 2012, so just 12, 14 years ago that I was there for that particular on that particular visit. But I managed, as I looked at the map, I thought, oh, well, I've been to four out of the six regions. And, in the travels on that tour, the food was quite, we had some quite different meals that were wonderful, but they were quite a bit different.
Yeah, well, yes. So those are the regional recipes that you'd have got. I don't know if you went to Yorkshire. I don't know if you tried any Yorkshire curd tart.
No, we were in the Northwest, Leeds, I think, Midlands. We were, I don't know, maybe Sheffield area. The eastern part, we were in maybe Norwich, and of course London in the southeast.
Yes. Well, London, they're very fond of jellied eels, which we never see in the north. Jellied eels is a very southern thing.
And what are they?
Well, they're eels.
Oh, jellied eels. I'm sorry. I misunderstood what you were saying. I thought it was some sort of jelly. Oh, jellied eels. We did not try jellied eels.
No, and what else do they have in London? Saveloys, which are a type of sausage, and that seems to be unique to the south around London. They have shops that sell those.
What? But, go ahead, sorry.
But in the north of England, we never see jellied eels.
Well, English food, now it had a bad rap. It's been called Blandenburg, and you even note that in the book at one point. And how did it get that label? Talk about that for a minute.
Well, I personally think it was the Victorians. I think they have a lot to answer for, because during the Victorian era, food generally was very plain and very dull, very brown and beige. And everything was cooked to death. I mean, Mrs. Beaton, in her famous cookbook, recommends boiling eggs for 20 minutes. Yeah. And cabbage was boiled for about 30 minutes in lots and lots of water. So it was practically tasteless by the time it was served. And I think that's such a shame. But we've come a long way since then.
You have indeed. Carol Wilson is our guest today. And she has this lovely book, a big book. It's over 600 pages. The title is Regional Cooking of England. And the subtitle, A Culinary Tour with More Than 280 Traditional Recipes. Questions, comments, experiences to share? Hope you joined in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas at WPR.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, and Lee Rayburn, our technical director. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking with Carol Wilson. Her book is titled Regional Cooking of England, subtitle A Culinary Tour with More Than 280 Traditional Recipes, filled with some wonderful recipes, some absolutely fantastic photography, and a great little history lesson for us in the book, which I found fascinating about food, the history of food in that country. Questions for her? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, email to ideas at wpr.org. And Tom in Madison has a comment, I believe. Tom, thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
And what have you got for us today?
Well, first of all, you have to know I'm 80, so I've been to England and the UK about 10 times since 1978. But just before I went to England in 1985, I read an article in the New York Times about Cockney cuisine. And one of the things I was talking about was jellied eel. And the best place to get it was at a walk-up stand on the East End called Tubby Isaac's. And every time I went to England after that, up until 2014, I think, I would always make a pilgrimage to Tubby Isaac's and have at least two or three bowls of jellied eel. And you just stand there and eat it. It's just a walk-up. And what's interesting is how many cars would drive up and stop and get their order and drive off. But unfortunately, before I went to England in 2014, it was announced that Tubby Isaac's was closing permanently. And I think your author probably knows this. One of the problems is there's a very big shortage of eel.
Oh, Tom, right. Thanks for calling. Comment, Carol.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. I think eels... I think it's not something that young people nowadays really want to eat. And I think Tubby Isaac's, which is a very famous shop, I think it's a shame that it's closed. But I think you can still buy jellied eels in London. But perhaps there aren't as many jellied eel shops nowadays as there used to be. But I'm glad that you enjoyed them, Tom.
Thanks a lot for calling, Tom. I was just thinking about my daughter, Emily, who's majoring in marine biology, and she's one of her jobs at the college is to take care of the shark tank, the big shark tanks and all the other tanks. And one of her jobs has been to feed a baby eel with a forceps because the baby eel was kind of afraid, and so when she just dropped quill into the tanks, other fish had come along and grab it. So she had to have had to feed the baby eel with the forceps.
Oh gosh!
Just a little aside that has nothing to do with the rest of the show, but it popped into my head when Tom called about jellied eel. Tom, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Steve and Rhinelander is with us. Steve, what's on your mind?
Well, good morning. Tell me about English bangers.
Okay. What's an English banger?
An English banger is a sausage. And we're very fond of our sausages in England. We can buy all sorts of different flavors. They're made with pork or beef, even lamb or chicken now. But sausages have been a long-standing part of the diet in England. Sausages and mash, known as bangers and mash, are probably very popular. The reason they're called bangers is because earlier sausages, and even in the 1950s, just after the Second World War, sausages were made with quite cheap meat. And the casings were quite cheap. So when they were put in the frying pan, they used to burst and they used to go bang. So that was why they became known as bangers.
Oh, that's a great story. Steve, thanks a lot for calling. And you know, Wisconsin, if you want to talk sausages, Wisconsin is, I think, has a worldwide reputation for its sausages. And when I sampled the sausages in England, I have to say the ones I sampled, I liked ours better.
Oh, that's very tactful.
Oh, well, you know, before we go too much further, tell us what readers of your cookbook are going to find between the covers.
Well, there's over 200 recipes for savory dishes, breakfast dishes, pies, which are very popular in England, and lots of puddings, desserts, sweets. We do have most people do have a sweet tooth, and we literally have hundreds and hundreds of recipes for puddings and desserts. In fact, even in 1698, a French visitor to England, François Misson, said, "Ah, what an excellent thing is an English pudding." So we were fond of our puddings even then. And Eliza Smith, who was a famous cookery writer, she wrote a book called The Complete Housewife in 1727. And it's got a huge number of recipes for puddings, boiled, baked, steamed, fried, iced puddings, jellies, trifles, all sorts of things. So we still eat those today, and we still enjoy our puddings.
I liked your puddings. I had puddings, I think, practically in every one of the regions that I was in at one point or another. You'd wind up with a pudding, and they were always good. Really yeah. good.
Did you have a favorite pudding, Larry?
The favorite pudding? Probably. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. It's 14 years ago. But I do remember. I remember really liking the puddings, but I couldn't put a name on any of them for you right off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. So what's that favorite pudding that you're talking about? You do have that in the cookbook.
Yes, at the moment, I think the favourite pudding in this country would be sticky toffee pudding. And that's not a very old recipe, actually. That came about, it was created either in the 1960s or the 70s, probably in the region of Cumbria here. And it's a dark pudding. It's made with dates and treacle. And it's served with a sticky toffee sauce, and it's usually served with cream or ice cream. So it's quite rich and sweet. That seems to be the nation's favourite pudding at the moment. But we have such a lot to choose from. There's Bakewell pudding from Derbyshire, which is maybe world famous now. And the old Bakewell pudding shop is still in the little town of Bakewell in Derbyshire, and it still sells little Bakewell puddings.
Oh, wonderful. Sorry. Tim in Hollandale. We'll go to you. Hi, Tim.
I married an English woman, so I go over occasionally. And HB sauce, why was it invented and what is it?
HB sauce.
Yes, HB sauce.
Right. HP sauce is a dark brown spicy sauce. It's kind of similar to Worcester sauce, but it's thicker. And we eat it with all sorts of things. We eat it with the English breakfast. We eat it with pies. We eat it with cold meats. It's dark and spicy. The actual recipe is a secret. But I don't know whether you like it. Do you?
You like it, Tim?
No, I absolutely was wondering, because we were eating breakfast and they were putting it on the breakfast, so I'm like,
"That's right,
yeah,
yes.
I'll give it a whirl." And why, you know, and I don't mind Worcestershire sauce, but yeah, that stuff was like, oof.
Right. It's very popular in England.
Oh, Tim, thanks for calling. By the way, you can join in too. Question or comment or an experience to share. We've heard some good ones here. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. I want you to talk about the history of calling a live animal a cow as an example, but when cooked, it's beef.
Oh, well, yes. yes. I suppose that's something that I hadn't thought of. Yeah, because there are two types of cattle that are reared. There's beef cattle, which are reared for their meat, and there are dairy cattle, which are just kept for their milk. So perhaps that's why we call those type of cows beef.
What did the Tudors bring to English cooking?
Tudors? Oh, no, let me think. Well, it was in the Tudor era that sugar became more plentiful. And so Elizabeth I had a well-known sweet tooth, and she loved things made of sugar. So the cooks at the court would create huge sculptures made of sugar, which would show off her wealth. But also, turkeys came to England in the Tudor era, in the reign of Henry VIII. I think they came from, I presume they came from America.
I would guess, yeah.
Yes. So Tudor England, and hops was another thing that came into Tudor England to make beer.
I'm trying to remember from, maybe it was from the book or maybe it was just out of my head from somewhere else, but they did not eat fresh fruits and vegetables or very much.
No, they were regarded as poisonous if they were eaten raw.
Oh, so, that's...
A lot of suspicion. So vegetables were always cooked at that time. But gradually, I think as people realised they weren't poisonous, they began to eat salads as well. So they did begin to eat them raw. So, yeah, it's all a matter of what people think about new foods when they come into the country, because when potatoes were introduced, somebody commented that they were related to deadly nightshade, so people wouldn't eat them for a long time.
Oh.
But now, of course, potatoes are a staple food here.
Absolutely. Roger in St. Charles, Illinois has something for us. Hi, Roger.
Hello.
Hello, Roger.
I was brought up in England. I was born just after the start of the war. So the first 30 years of my life was English cooking. And I never thought of it as boring at all. We used to have a rabbit stew probably a couple of times a month. We had a leg of lamb on a regular basis. And these certainly weren't cooked to destruction.
They were not. Well, no.
I think it was the Victorians who were very fond of cooking food for a long time. And gradually, as more was known about nutrition and vitamins, people realised things didn't have to be cooked for such a long time. And of course, England has got a variety of fantastic foods, beef and cheese, and all sorts of vegetables and fruits that we grow. And, of course, people used to grow food in their gardens. So they grow vegetables and they grow fruits. And they used to go out to forage in the hedgerows if they lived in the countryside and make a lot of jams and sauces. And so, no, I mean, English food has a very undeserved reputation for being bland and boring.
Roger, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Susie in Presque Isle, what's on your mind?
Hi there. I went to school in London in 1971 and fell in love with all English foods. I went up to Denbighdale in Yorkshire, and my foster family made fabulous trifles and custards. And I cannot make a custard here for the life of me. Is the milk different? I've even used the bird's custard that you can buy now in a lot of shops. It doesn't taste like the fabulous stuff in England.
Wow.
Right. Well, there is a recipe for custard sauce in the book. I know Bird's custard is very famous and it's ready made. But what didn't you like about the custard that you made yourself?
It just didn't taste as good. I'm also in adoration of Devonshire cream and scones, and the scones don't taste the same here. Americans make scones like, I don't know, rolls or something. They're not like English scones. What's the trick, do you think, for custard?
Well, basically, it's just eggs and milk.
Whole milk?
Whole milk, oh yes, whole milk and eggs and sugar, of course. And maybe the custard that you tried in London was maybe had some cream in it to make it more creamy?
I think so, and I'm just wondering if it's pasteurized versus unpasteurized milk. It's the quality of the milk is creamier in England somehow?
Ah, right. Well, we buy whole milk here. It's always pasteurized. But we can also buy something called Gold Top milk, which is from the Channel Islands, Jersey and Guernsey. And that is very, very creamy and very rich. So if you can't buy that there, what I would suggest is that you substitute some of the milk in your custard for single cream.
Oh, that might be worth a try. Susie, you should take a look at Carol's book, Regional Cooking of England, and we'll get yourself a copy and try the recipe that she has and go with the cream. my gosh. Barbara emailed to ask what's the to-do over mushy peas. When she went to London, they were on every menu. She ordered it very light green on the plate, but why mash them?
Right. Well, mushy peas are different from garden peas because they are made from dried peas that are soaked for a long time to soften them, and then they're boiled so that they turn into a mush. And originally they were a northern recipe, but now they're nationally popular. Usually them with fish and chips.
Well, fish and chips. If you came to Wisconsin, if you come and visit us in Wisconsin, you have to stop by and say hello, Carol. But if you came here to this state, you would soon find that every Friday there are fish fries in almost every restaurant, certainly every restaurant that I ever visit has a Friday night fish fry.
Oh. Well, Friday was a traditional day to eat fish and chips here. But now, of course, you know, people buy them all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, we've eaten fish and chips in this country since about 1860, when the first fish and chip shop opened in London. And actually, Charles Dickens mentions fried fish sellers. They were among the street sellers of London, but they weren't. But the fried fish wasn't served with chips. It was served with bread. So if you were a street seller in London, you would sell a piece of bread with your fried fish. I think it's mentioned in Oliver Twist.
Matt in Alloway emailed a comment about some of the names of English food are very unappealing.
Oh!
Well, he mentions Toad in the Hole. He mentions Spotted Dick. He mentions Baby's Head Pudding.
Well, dick is the old English word for pudding. So, but nobody knows why, but that was an accepted term for pudding. So spotted dick is a steamed pudding, which is studded with dried fruits like currants and sultanas. I think you call sultanas white raisins. And toad in the hole. Well, that's sausages that's baked in a batter pudding.
And you've got a beautiful recipe for it in the book and a photo.
Yes.
I have to say that the photography, well, the writing is, you're really a good writer.
But oh, thank you.
But the photography is just outstanding, not only of the food, but of the English countryside.
Yes.
It's just a marvel.
I've done a great job, yes. It's lovely.
It absolutely is. And you know what? I'm looking at this book. It's a large book, kind of a heavy book, because you used the highest quality paper stock and very high, as I said, very high-end photography in the book. And I was really surprised how inexpensive this book is, given what a person has in front of them.
It's quite a heavy book, isn't it?
Yeah, I was, Lee Rabin and I were, you know, Lee thought maybe it was 8 pounds. I didn't put it on the scale, but it is, but it's also 650 or so pages.
Yes, yeah.
And it is a just a marvelous little history of the food of regional foods of England, with accompanying photography not only of the food itself but of the countryside. And it's just a lovely. It's the kind of book you're never going to let go of.
Yes, you'd be able to dip into it from time to time and hopefully try some of the recipes, at least, and find out about the history of them, where they came from, because there are so many English recipes which have often been handed down through generations for hundreds of years. And all the recipes are easy to follow, by the way, and you'll be able to achieve fantastic results in your home kitchen. You don't need any special equipment or anything.
Nor do you need a lot of, you know, special things that you might not find in your own pantry, to be honest.
Which I
liked a lot. And you take into account we Americans, too, in when it comes to amounts and so forth. It's there's kind of both the British and the American way of saying certain things.
Yes. Yeah.
It has been delightful talking with you, Carol. I want to thank you so much for being with us today, and certainly for putting this book together. It's a classic. Thank you very much for being with us.
Really, thank you for talking to me.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you, Carol.
Thanks.
Carol Wilson, the author, and the book Regional Cooking of England, subtitled A Culinary Tour, with more than 280 traditional recipes. And they are easy to follow recipes. And, you know, it's called A Culinary Tour. And speaking of tours, if you can read her book and get the tour that way, or maybe you want to do a culinary tour and actually go and visit the place, the UK, and not only England, but Scotland. And I'll be going to Scotland in the fall. I'm looking forward to that. Northern Ireland. I tell you what, our next guest today knows a whole lot about culinary tours and tours in general. Carrie Mulliken, our guest, back with us from Bon Voyage World Travel Experts. Our next guest. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.